Welcome to the Living Life on Purpose podcast with your host, Michael Mukunda Chandra Kohan, the founder of YourWellnessYogi.com and the Living Life on Purpose community. The Living Life on Purpose podcast is a show dedicated to inspiring people to achieve their goals and live their dreams to the highest potential. Life is short. Learn to live it on purpose. Inside all of us is a powerful spark of the divine, and yet as life's challenges grind and wear us down, many of us forget that inner spark. However, that spark never leaves us, and if we stray too far from it, we will be unhappy in our life. At Your Wellness Yogi and the Living Life on Purpose community, we are dedicated to helping you discover that inner spark in life. We offer a variety of life coaching packages that meet your needs and budget. We have group coaching, monthly mindfulness mastermind calls, and one-to-one coaching. Get started today and take advantage of our two free personal one-to-one coaching conversations by taking the Circle of Life quiz, a free life assessment tool that helps you reveal the big picture of your true dreams and paves the road for real personalized action plan to take control of your life. Visit yourwellnessyogi.com/life. Before we get started, I wanted to ask you a favor, to write us an honest review of our podcast. By writing us a review, you will help raise our profile so more people can find us on iTunes. Visit yourwellnessyogi.com/podcast and click on subscribe to open up in iTunes and write us a review. You can also write us a review on your device as you listen to the show by opening up the podcast app. Thank you and enjoy this week's episode, and I appreciate you listening. Today's guest is Clarissa Hughes, a mindfulness coach. Clarissa Hughes faced many of the challenges that come with juggling a career and family and living in a 24/7 demanding world. She spent a lot of time trying to please a lot of people and yet often still end up merely feeling anxious, guilty, inadequate, tired, and overwhelmed with life. She fell into a pattern of work and sleep and eat and was unclear about what truly mattered to her. A job crisis woke her up. She became aware that to start thriving, she needed to slow down and take responsibility for her choices and actions rather than feeling like a victim to her life. She needed to learn how to say no to those things and people that didn't align to what brings joy, meaning, and purpose to her life. She needed to find some self-compassion and practice self-care. She trained in mindfulness with breath work and became a I-Rest yoga nidra trainer. On that journey, she became acutely aware of how small mindful moments scattered throughout their daily life help people. In her mindfulness business, she empowers and supports people to creatively respond rather than react to life's challenges, to help them cultivate greater self-love so they can live a life that is awake, alive, and aligned with what truly matters to them. Hey, Clarissa, it's great to have you on this show. Let's just start right off the bat and kind of explain to our audience in one or two sentences, what do you actually do?
Well, thank you, first of all, Michael, for inviting me onto the show. And I'm a mindfulness coach, and I help people to really be calmer, to become more confident, and to find ways to know that they have a choice in life to respond this way or to react. And that's what mindfulness is. It's really about learning to choose how you want your life to be.
Can you go in a little bit more details for me about what mindfulness is and how it helps you make choices? We get a lot of people talking about mindfulness these days, but nobody really goes into full details. And one of the reasons why I'd like to have you on the show is the fact that you have professional certifications in mindfulness coaching, and you're not just teaching mindfulness as a term to explain what you do.
No, that's right. I mean, I think though you're right, there's a lot of misconceptions. So let me put this kind of straight. Mindfulness is a way of living. It's not 10 minutes of pushing an app and meditating every day. I love meditation and it's part of mindfulness, but mindfulness is a way of living. It's our ability to practice being aware, knowing that we can be in the present moment all the time. It's exercises, it's using our breath and our body to bring us back into the present moment, because our brains love to be in the future or thinking about what somebody said 2 days ago that I can't change. But when we're in the present moment, we're making choices about how we react. We're making choices about our life, and we feel calmer when we're in the present moment. You know, we're not thinking and we're not so anxious about what's going to happen or what did happen.
So I have attention deficit hyperactive disorder, and I'm also a very type A person where I like to set goals and I like to kind of create a vision of my future. And I have a tendency at times to be stressed out about income and making enough money to support my life and my partner and create a business that can support both of us so we can live a spiritually balanced life. And at times I find myself daydreaming or thinking about the future and thinking about all the goals I'm going to achieve and what my life will be like. And how can I, as a practitioner, what exercises can I use to help me bring me more focus into the present and not so much about thinking of the future?
So one of the most effective ways is always breathing, and actually to have a few moments when you can actually focus on your breath. We can all do some breathing where we either count our breath, we can count equal breath in and out for a few moments. We can do some deep breathing so that we breathe more into our belly. Those things bring us into our body and bring us into our present moment. Because when the brain, in your thinking about counting, breathe in, breathe out, you know, in those moments, your brain can't do two things at once. It can't be in the future, you know, thinking about things. It's here. And that's when we have that little space of mindfulness, of calm, because we're right in the present moment. So breath is the one of the simplest ways. Sorry, Michael.
I was going to say, is there anything else besides breathing? Because one of the things that I find, and I'm sure other people in my shoes find, that when we return to the breath for that few moments, I'm great. I'm breathing. I'm tired. Good. Breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out. And then I go back to worrying about paying my bills, worrying about building my business, worrying about my health, and worrying about my family. Is there anything I can do to kind of get that noise in my head out and be able to kind of get it out and be able to examine it so I don't keep having the same thoughts over and over again?
Well, one of the things about practicing mindfulness meditations as well, breathing's one of them, or anchoring yourself in your body so that you're actually thinking I'm more here in my body, body scans or grounding exercises like mindful walking. So you can walk from one meeting to the next if you're in an office, or go for a walk and just walk mindfully. You're grounding yourself in your body. And as a yoga practitioner, you can do that too. Those moments when we're in our bodies, you know, I'm feeling my seat on the chair, my feet are on the floor. We're coming back into the present moment. So the grounding in the body is the other way, which is a bit different from breath. And we can do that. We might have to do that hundreds of times a day to bring ourselves back and calm our thoughts. But go. Okay, I didn't add. One of the things I would say as well is that as we get more used to doing some of the mindfulness meditations, we do find that we can actually work with our thoughts more. We're learning to let our thoughts be there and acknowledge them. So we're not trying to push away the negative thoughts. That's what mindfulness teaches us, that what we resist persists. So by letting those thoughts be, acknowledging that they're there, and then kind of going, well, thank you, and then turning on our minds towards what we're doing right in the present moment, helps those thoughts over time to quieten.
Okay, that makes sense. That's actually a very practical way of approaching our subconscious mind to be able to get away from the fears that we live day in and day out. What would you say to someone who typically, that I find as Westerners, is, and they say, I'm not good at meditation. And I'm sure you get that also. What's the response that you say to people who say, I'm not good at meditation, or I don't know how to meditate?
I think I'm not good at meditation is one where I would just say everybody can meditate. And it's there's no good because there is no right or wrong. It's literally learning to sit there and be with yourself, with your thoughts. If you say I'm not good, then what you probably need to do is to work with a teacher. You may be struggling with an app and you're not quite sure. And having a teacher initially teach you to meditate, to guide you and support you and encourage you really helps. Because then you're learning that the things you feel are happening or the things you're observing happening to everybody. If I can tell a little story, I went on a meditation retreat last year, and some of the people in that room had meditated for 40 or 50 years. Guess what? They had days when they couldn't meditate they had their heads were full of thoughts running around and they couldn't focus on their breath. But they were able to accept that was just normal and come back to the practice the next time. So it's not about how long you've been doing it or being good or bad. It's just some days are better than others. And having a teacher or a mentor to help you is a great way to get over the I can't meditate or I'm finding it hard.
I think that's great advice because a lot of times when I'm meditating and I'm sitting in my quiet space, my mind is going in 90 directions and I'm just trying to quiet it down. And usually for me, what I do is I just generally ask the question, like, why do I keep thinking about Clarissa and why does she keep annoying me? I'm using your name as an example to connect to you. And what's that mean in relationship to me? Or why am I always stressed about my finances? What am I worrying about? Am I overextending my money or am I within budget? And I find that what I do is afterwards, I write down kind of the reoccurring thought patterns that I have and then begin to examine if they're accurate or they're based in fear. My question would be is why do we as practitioners of meditation and spirituality always continue to seem to dwell on the same topics or the same subjects? I don't have enough money. I'm not connected to my partner. I feel disconnected into this world. I don't have any friends. Nobody likes me. It seems to be these days the same general reoccurring themes. And what do you think the reason for that is?
I think they're just our normal thoughts that are running around and quite often they're outwardly focused. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we are very outward focused. We look forward where our eyes look forward. So we're always thinking about what's going on in the outside world. And that's probably why we feel like that. Part of a mindfulness practice, as I said, is acknowledging or accepting those thoughts mm-hmm. and then learning to turn to the more positive. So we're allowing negativity be there. We can't get rid of it. The mind is hardwired to the negative, to use Rick Hansen's term, and he's right. But if we can be more accepting of them, then we can turn to more pleasant things and let them come in. And the more we do that, we rewire our neural pathways to more positive thinking over time. And it starts really small. Yep. We notice a little flower, a little this, a little that.
Do you think negative thought patterns are addictive? Do you think that's why we tend to have more negative thoughts? And is it for reaction?
Do you know, I don't think they're addictive. I think they're part of being human. because we're an animal that's, you know, really in reality, still physiologically, we're like our ancestors and they were looking to survive, run away from a mammoth or a saber-toothed tiger. That was hard to say. And we have those same reactions. The problem is we're having them to an email or something on the TV or social media. which isn't, of course, the same threat mechanism. And so we're negative. We don't like things we don't understand or that are new, that feel like they're threatening. So we constantly responding. We've got a fantastic fight flight mechanism in our body, which you need if your kid runs in the road or someone pulls out in the traffic in front of you. But learning to manage that is part of mindfulness, acknowledging those fears and those negative thoughts, and then letting them just be there. They will quieten down if you practice mindfulness. They're always there, but we don't need to let them be in control.
Do you think social media, I know this is something that people talk about all the time, but do you think that social media and the 24-hour news cycle is adding to the sense of negative thoughts and comparing and contrasting and not living up to modern standards of what it means to be happy, healthy, and successful? Do you think the standards are just unattainable today?
Yes, and I think social media can be very, very harmful to our mental health. Even though I love it and I use it like everybody else, it's because it's so invasive and uncontrollable, and it's quite addictive. And there's enough evidence coming through now that social media can be very addictive. People are looking at their phones 150 times a day, 3 or 4 hours on this stuff, and we're not controlling it. And news channels, you know, they know that we're hardwired to the negative. They put far more emphasis on negative news, negative events, because they know that we'll engage with it, because our brains are looking for it. They're looking for that negative that makes us feel, oh, yeah, I'm okay, that's bad too, and we latch on to it. And so it kind of builds a vicious cycle.
So I wanted to ask two things right there. So you were talking about how the news is the modern 24-hour news cycle focuses on the negative news cycle versus the positive news cycle because we latch onto it. Is that due to flight or fight, and that's due to seeing that's going to hurt us, so we need to be aware of it and run away from it? Is that why we're addicted to it? Why are we addicted to that negative news cycle?
Exactly like you said there, Michael. You know, we have a tendency, we're tendency to the negative. We remember the negative events. You know, you only need one negative event for it to stick in your head. So we remember things, and we look for reinforcement of those messages. And the reality is that there's probably more positive things going on in the world, but they would fly by quite quickly. You need 6 positive events for every 1 negative one to stick in the brain, because our neural pathways are wired to the negative.
Wow, that's crazy. Like that, I never really thought of it that way, that you really need to be reinforced that often with positive events, because in order to override a negative event in your life, or a negative news or a negative experience, that's a lot to compete against. What suggestions do you have that's just trying to, like, get ahead in life, pay their bills, live a quiet life, have a family? What do you suggest that they do in order to kind of focus more on positive experiences and have more positive experiences without kind of tuning out to the world? Like, how can we be responsible citizens, but at the same time not live in this state of fear?
I think the first thing is to look for the positive. And a great place to start is a gratitude practice. And I get a lot of my clients to write down every single night 10 things. And they look at me and they go, 10 things I'm grateful for? And I go, yep, 10. Because, you know, they think they can do 1 or 2. But, you know, we can think of all the things, and they're little things. You know, like the sun shone today, there was a flower came out, I had a warm shower, I had cool water to drink. They're all things. They're positive things, and we're looking at them and we're grateful. And gratitude practices are now, you know, almost scientifically proven to help us be more positive, to be happier. So that's one space where we can really start to build up a practice, write it down before you go to bed each night. And we're building that, looking at the positive, you know, so all the time there's something positive. And then the other thing I say to people is put your phone away, even for a little while, and look up. Look around you when you're out walking. You'll always see something good. If you're kind of open to it, mm-hmm. You'd be amazed what you can see. Smile at a person. Maybe you saw a child on the street. We're all the time looking for those little positive moments in our daily life. Then those two simple things that we can do and still live our life without having to detox ourselves or from the mobile phone or social media starts to make us naturally look more and more for positive.
I think that's great advice. And I think that's one of the things that I'm going to start doing. My life partner, her and I, we have a tendency to try to read before we go to bed. And then we try to read our bedtime affirmations, but we never really thought about adding a gratitude exercise where we can sit down and list 10 things that we're grateful for. And I think I'm going to start doing that as a couple. Like we're going to, so I only have to do 5 and she only has to do 5 to make my life easier.
And I think that's the great thing because we will all have those things. Even people, when I sometimes work with people who have chronic pain, it may well be that the sun did shine through their window that day, or a little bird flew by, or something like that. So even people who really have a difficult life can find small points of happiness, small points of positivity.
Yeah, I like the expression in related to people that are going through a difficult part in life, that the expression is, I have some bad news for you. Everything in your life is going to change and end one day. But I have some good news for you. Everything in your life is going to change and end one day. So you might as well begin to work on changing your life and then rather than sitting in your problems. And some people have some real problems. But if we focus on those real problems, then all we do is continue to suffer and we continue to repeat that same cycle. And why do you think people continue this to like repeat the same problems over and over again? And how can mindfulness help us break out of that same cycle of getting into toxic relationships and surrounding ourselves with negative people, overspending? How can mindfulness help us change our patterns so we no longer continue to fall in that same trap day in and day out?
So I'd answer that in two ways. The first is about awareness, because mindfulness is about cultivating awareness. We spend so much of our time on automatic pilot, so we just keep repeating things and we're not even really conscious of them. And so mindfulness cultivates awareness of what you're doing, what your thought patterns are like, how you're living your life, how much time you're giving to negative energy things and how much time you're giving to things that motivate and sustain you. So pure and simple awareness is the first stage. And, you know, in any mindfulness training or teaching, that's a big part of the kind of programs that any mindfulness teacher would do with you, is to spend a fair bit of time working through your awareness. The other side is compassion, because we have to have compassion for ourselves before we can have compassion for other people. And cultivating compassion and learning to become kinder towards yourself is the next phase after awareness. And that helps us then to learn to say, I don't want to be in this relationship, to say no to extra workloads. Because in a sense, you've got an awareness of where you are, and then you're able to do things in a way that's good for you. You're becoming your own best friend.
I think that's great. I think that's really good advice. I know one of the things that we talked about before we got on the show that I have in my notes is the concept of being overworked and overbooked. And one of the things that I know you focus on is how to reduce exhaustion and thrive. So can we talk about that a little bit now and switch topics?
We can indeed. Yeah, exhaustion is real for a lot of people. And it happens, you know, very gradually. It's not like suddenly we were, all okay, and next minute we're exhausted. I mean, that's temporarily kind of tiredness. Mm-hmm. It chips away at the person. We have a great sort of, you know, model that we work with, which is called the exhaustion funnel, which I didn't make up, which a great professor here in Sweden, Professor Mari Åsberg, she's a leading stress and burnout specialist at the big teaching hospital in Stockholm, Karolinska. And she has created this model, and it's so true. You know, we're all okay. We're bobbing along, we're working, eating, resting, doing all the things that we want to do. And then somebody puts a whole lot of extra work on your desk. And the first thing that we do as people is we drop something that's good for us. You know that one when you say, or you ring up your friend and say, oh God, I've got so much work to do. I'm really sorry we can't go for dinner tonight. And then you say, oh, I need to drop the yoga practice because I haven't finished this work yet. And suddenly we get to Friday, we've dropped off a few things and we feel really tired. We spend the whole weekend scrabbling to get back to some sort of sense of normality. And then it starts all over again. The work doesn't go away. You keep dropping off the things that sustain you. And before you know it, you're kind of a worky and sort of half sleep because you're probably not sleeping that well. And you're in the bottom of exhaustion. And it happens really fast like that you chip away, chip away, chip away, chip away. And then you're there like that at the bottom of that funnel.
Well, then how can I, because that as a yoga teacher, as a life coach, and as a wellness entrepreneur, and my life partner is a yoga teacher who does and also does special needs, how can we reset when we become overwhelmed? When something happens in my life where I have to take on a responsibility, how can I become aware of it? And how can I then take that time to kind of not become overexhausted? How can I not overextend myself?
I think one of the very simple things that I work with is to get people to actually look at where they're directing their energy. So, and I get them to literally list all the things in life that sustain them, things that they can do. And, you know, people should write things like going for a coffee with my friend, going to my yoga class, cooking a meal for a friend, whatever it is, you know, it doesn't need to be the big things. Write those things down and actually write down the ones that you do, not the things that you just like to do and never do. You know, it's a good saying, I love to go to the cinema, but I go once a week, or the movies, I go once a week or once a year or never. You have to write down the things you really do. And then I get people to list all the things in their life that drain the energy out of them. You know, I've got a long commute I have to sit in the traffic a lot. My one is I hate ironing. And I used to hate when I had piles and piles of ironing. I just look at it and I go, I really can't do this. And I used to spend 2 hours trying to catch up and I'd feel really drained by it. So it's often not the big stuff, but looking at those. And I also get people to look at what I call energy vampires. So those kind of people in your life and those kind of situations that really are toxic. And then I look at all that energy that I call a sloth. You know, when you like Netflix and too much time on social media, they're not bad in small doses, but they're not very good for you if you do too much. And then look at what have you got in your life? And have you got more drainers than you have sustainers? Because then you've got a problem. You've got to drop some of those. But then looking, make sure you've got more sustainers in your life, more things that support you than you have drainers. Try and look at the drainers and say, can I get rid of this? Could I change this? Could I delegate this? Could I say no to this? Because once you have to, then you have to take action. Because firstly, you're aware, and then you have to take action.
I wanted to take a quick break and remind you that it is never too late to make a choice and decide to make lasting changes in your life and create the life you want and learn to live life on purpose. At Your Wellness Yogi and the Living Life on Purpose community, we are dedicated to helping you discover that spark in life. We offer a variety of life coaching packages that meet your needs and budget. We have group coaching, monthly mindfulness mastermind calls, and one-to-one coaching. Get started today and take advantage of our 2 free personal one-to-one coaching conversations by taking the Circle Life Quiz, our free life assessment tool that helps you reveal the big picture of your true dreams and paves the road for a real personalized action plan to take control of your life. Visit yourwellnessyogi.com/life.
I want to know because I don't really know what to do here. And I always get mixed messages. I worked really hard. I'm tired at the end of the day. And I'm glad that I'm tired at the end of the day. It means I did my best. How much television am I or should I allow myself to watch every day? What's appropriate and what's like excessive? I just want to get a simple answer from someone.
I think if you're enjoying and engaging with the program that you're watching, that's great, because that's something active. If you're watching something you really enjoy, then it's a sustainer, isn't it? It's good for you. You're getting some positive energy from it. And if that lasts for half an hour or you last for 2 hours, that's good. If it's just vegging out and it's on and it's noise and you're looking at your phone and your iPad and your computer, then it's not adding any value to you. If it was half an hour or 2 hours or 3 hours, it's more about what it's giving you than the length of time.
Do you mind if we switch topics? There's something I really wanted to talk about that I love that you put down as one of the questions or topics that you wanted to talk about today. And it's something that I kind of always kind of face, is the concept of love and how sometimes love can be tough. What do you mean by that?
And this is me very much talking about self-care and self-compassion. There is a very consumerist view out there of what self-care is. Oh, have a massage, eat some chocolate.
Oh, I know. Like, have a massage, eat some chocolate, take a gentle yoga class. You know, that's self-love. Yes. It confuses me.
And it confuses me too, but I understand it's being sold, and we live in a very quick fix consumerist world, and that looks good, doesn't it? And the reality of that is, no, that's not always what self-care is. Sometimes we do have to be aware, and being aware can be a bit tough. I mean, mindfulness isn't all, you know, roses and wonderful. Sometimes it's about looking at yourself and knowing what you do and how you feel about things, how you're reacting, and having to make a change, making a choice of how you want to be. And if you take an example here, if you have really bad debts and you're struggling with money, then self-care is not taking a massage that costs $100. It's actually taking a hard, good look at your debts and deciding, maybe I need a second job. Maybe I need to cut up my credit cards. Maybe I need someone to help me here. And then I'm actually loving myself, because I'm actually doing something that at the moment is probably filling my mind with negative thoughts, keeping me up at night, and it's affecting my life. But by bringing awareness to it, and by making a choice to do something about it, I'm caring much more for myself.
Would you consider that, in Sanskrit, we call it a tapasya, self-sacrifice, like work, taking, you know, being willing to kind of go through the hardship in order to kind of nurture the self? Is that kind of what you're trying to get to?
Yes, I think sometimes we do need to do that. It's hard to say that it's tough love, but sometimes it's about facing up to some of those things and making a proactive change, changing the way you respond to that situation, or actually changing the situation. That's mindfulness in daily life. It's, you know, it's not all about meditating. It is about doing some of these more difficult things. But in so doing, you're acting with self-compassion and with self-care. Mm-hmm.
So then how come, as you said it, we have this image that self-love, self-care, especially in the spiritual mindfulness community, is always this about like somebody sitting in like on the beach at some resort or up in the mountains wearing like really nice athletic gear with a sunset in the background, their hands in namaste mudra, or they're lying down in a spa, getting a massage, and they're just smiling. Why do we think that's self-love? And when we think about the things that are hard, like cutting our expenses or going to a yoga class that's not necessarily easy, that puts us outside our comfort zone, or taking the time to talk to someone that says, no, you're doing this wrong and you need to change your life. Why do we like to think self-love is all that like kind of nice picturesque stuff, and all that other stuff, all that work, that hardship is like not part of that self-love? I know it's marketed, but why internally? Is it due to the marketing, or is it something else?
I think it's partly due to the marketing. And I think it's another side of it. We like to resist the negative and grasp after the pleasant. Mm. So we want to push away the bad stuff. We want it just to go away. And we love grasping after the pleasant, which is very different from what I talked about earlier, which is allowing and acknowledging the bad and then seeking out the good. That's the way we build more positive lives. But actually just going, I hate this stuff. I don't want to do this. I'm not going to look at it. Of course, the more you resist it, as I said, it's there and it keeps coming back going, hello, you need to deal with this, because it never gets better till you do deal with it. And then we just grasp. So we go, oh, that's nice. That's nice. That's a shiny, shiny, nice new thing. I like that. And then the hard marketing sells that in even more.
This mala bead's going to make you be more spiritual. It was chanted on this mantra with these, you know, different color beads, and all your problems now will go away. Or if you go on this retreat and spend $2,200, you're going to have marital problems going to be resolved. And if you take this one seminar, you're going to come back and you're going to have no financial problems. Instead of you need to sit down and you need to spend the next 6 months working hard, sacrificing and being diligent in order to take care of yourself instead. And that doesn't sell. The quick fix, you know, step out of your life, that's what sells, is what you're saying.
Yeah, it's what sells. It's what's marketed really well. And I mean, the people who market it are very good marketeers. You know, they're selling it very well. They're selling a dream. We love the shiny things. We're addicted to the new. We look for what our eyes point forward. So we're always looking to the future and go, oh, that would be so cool, you know, and grasp the nice thing, enjoy it. The reality is that at the end of that, you're probably $2,200 more in debt and it'll come back to bite you. And so I think part of that, and I've been reading a very interesting practice from Bodhipaksha, who owns Wild Mind, and he says, have compassion for your future self. He said your current self wants to buy the shoes or wants to buy the nice shiny self-care thing. But he said if you paused for a moment and thought about how does your future self going to feel, then you'd have more compassion for that future self. You wouldn't buy the thing. Because at the end of the month, guess what? You'd feel a lot better if you didn't. So he says, take a pause and have compassion for your future self.
Now, where do you think, from a Western standpoint, because we're Westerners, where do you think spirituality, mindfulness, and yoga, where do you think it's going to go in the next 10 years? Do you think it will become less commercialized? And sort of this wave of spirituality, the wave of new age books, do you think they will begin to kind of recede? Or do you think that we're just in the beginning of the marketing of this new age spiritual life of consumer spirituality?
I think that's quite a difficult question, because if mindfulness practices and yoga become more part of daily life, then the marketing may well become less intense. At the moment, everybody's jumping on the bandwagon and the hype and the wanting to do it because it's new and it sells.
Right.
It may well become just part of everyday life because something else will come along. You know, it's almost like you're hearing, oh, yoga's all over now. Now it's meditation. So what comes next? What's the next new shiny toy for the marketeers to push out at us? I think mindfulness may continue to grow because I think business realizes it needs to change. Leadership in business needs to change. And there's a big emphasis on changing corporate cultures through mindfulness. So it may become more part of daily life and therefore less interesting to a marketeer if it's something that's part of everybody's life and part of people's health programs. But we're not at that stage yet. So I still see a lot of hype. I see a lot of all sorts of people jumping on who have little or no training in yoga, little or no training in mindfulness, you know, jumping on there and making as much money as they can. And that's likely to continue for a little while, sadly, because I think it's kind of getting we're having definitely what's called muck mindfulness, a kind of a McDonaldized version of it. And, you know, the only thing is if something adverse happens, then it may well go against the whole movement.
Yeah, I find from my experience, I put people and I usually come across into two categories. The first category is the person who got into yoga, meditation, and wanted to become a life coach because it became their calling. Yoga, spirituality, it just became part of who they were, and they embodied it as a practitioner, that they got up in the morning, they meditated, they went to yoga class, they spent all their free time and their, like, you know, entertainment money on going on yoga retreats and attending meditation workshops, and decided to become like a mindfulness life coach. And that's the one category. And then the other category of people I come across are, they lost their job, and they can't find a new job, and they see on social media all these life coaches, all these like life coach celebrities that are making, they're crushing it financially, or the yoga celebrities, and they're like, I'm going to do this thing as my career because I don't have any other options. And that's why I find that I run across those two people that generally fit into those two categories, that I'm generalizing it. And I find over time, the ones that have it as their calling, as a life coach, a mindfulness coach, a health coach, a yoga teacher, that they embody it as who they are in their entire mind, body, and soul, they're the ones I see 5 years later. The ones that are like, this is going to be my money thing because I don't know what else to do, I just lost my job, I find that they don't last. Do you find that to be similar?
I think that's true, because those people move on to the next new thing that can make them a dollar. Or two or three or whatever. I think I've seen this in the mindfulness. Suddenly people with no training decide they want to be a coach. Then they're going to throw in some mindfulness classes. They have actually no idea what mindfulness is. I'm teaching people to be calm. And I'm like, oh, that's kind of interesting, since it's about teaching people to have choice and awareness with compassion. Calm comes as a sort of side benefit to it, but it's not the central feature of why we're doing it.
I'm a mindfulness coach, and I am not calm. I am a high energy individual. I have ADHD, so I have a tendency to be hyper, and I am definitely a practitioner of mindfulness. And so, like, yeah, I agree with you. Mindfulness is not about being calm. You can be high energy and still be mindful.
Absolutely. My own teacher is. I mean, she's so much energy and so much drive that it's got nothing to do with being kind of the kind of modern view of calm. So I think people are jumping on the bandwagon. I'm seeing a lot of people that are chucking this into their stuff, and they'll lose interest in it and move on to the next thing. Those of us that are still here, and I mean, if you look at some really well-known mindfulness teachers, they've been around, and John Kabat-Zinn and James Bartz. I mean, they've been around now for 30, 40 years, and they're still plugging away, saying a lot of the same things, bringing it into the modern context, and that's going to persist. For those of us that have it in our hearts, and it's who we are, it's part of our definition of us as a person, we'll be here and we'll still be helping and working with people down the line for many years to come.
So what's your advice for any person, and we're almost done with our time, so what's your advice for any person on two fronts? One, let's ask, what's your advice for anybody who wants to begin to practice mindfulness? And then my second question is, what is your advice for anybody who wants to begin to become a mindfulness life coach? What are your two suggestions there?
I would really say learn mindfulness from an accredited practitioner. It doesn't matter what school they've come from, but if they've done MBSR, which is the most common, then that person is a responsible mindfulness teacher. They have been taught how to teach you to do this in a proper and safe practice. They can support you, and you can probably continue to connect with that person on retreats and other things going down the line, like catch-up groups or whatever. So you're starting with a good understanding of what it is and build on that. That's what I would say if that's what. If you want to become a teacher, then train with an accredited school, you know, one that's recognized. I mean, here in Europe, the rules are quite strict. In the UK, where I was doing a lot of my training, there's only certain people who can train you to be a mindfulness teacher that you'll get any recognition from. So if you don't train with them, then you aren't really recognized. But look for people. I mean, in the US, you've got lots of great teachers, lots of good people who can train people to become a mindfulness, so that you learn how to teach it in the right way. You're also doing a lot as a teacher or a teacher in training. It, the practice is about self-reflection. It's not all about just chucking out the course with the course notes. It's about you growing as a person. A lot of the work is self-reflection, what happens when you do the practices, what do you feel? And it's also about what happens when you teach other people. You reflect back. How did I manage this? What's coming up for me? Because that you're learning from your students and they're learning from you, even as you're training to be a teacher. So train with people who can help you and get a great mentor and continue with that mentor, even if you get accredited. Because that mentor helps you and you go on continuous professional development because things move on and you need to be understanding how you can bring more and more and enrich more and more for the people that you're serving.
Great advice. And so where can anybody find you? Where are you in the virtual world?
In the virtual world, I have a website, which is thelittlebreathingspace.com. And they can find me there, and there will be links there to my social media. So I'm also on Facebook and Instagram as The Little Breathing Space.
Great. Anything, any other advice before we audience?
I think, you know, practice mindfulness. It's a daily practice, so you can't do it once in a while and hope you're going to be mindful. So, you know, make 10 minutes in your day minimum, and it will make a big difference to your life.
Thank you for listening to the Living Life on Purpose podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please subscribe to our show in iTunes and write us a review. By writing us a review, you will help raise our profile so more people can find us on iTunes. Links to our sponsors and other tools can be found in our show notes along with other useful information. For more information on our yoga and coaching classes, please visit our website at yourwellnessyogi.com and please sign up for our newsletter. Life is short. Learn to live it on purpose.